Up next on Larry's World, host Larry Magid speaks with Lee Felsenstein, who moderated the meeting at the Homebrew Computer Club where Steve Wozniak first introduced the Apple I. It's Apple's 30th anniversary on IT Conversations.
Apple's 30th anniversary is a great time to look back at where we came from, where we are, and where we're going. And there's no better person to take us on that journey than Lee Felsenstein. Lee is truly a pioneer in personal computing, having moderated meetings of the Homebrew Computer Club, where Steve Wozniak showed off the first Apple I. Lee, an engineer, is responsible for the design of numerous products, including the Sol, which preceded the Apple, and the Osborne One, arguably the first portable PC and the first PC to be bundled with the full suite of software. He is also a social activist and is currently working on a project that would provide communications infrastructure to developing countries as a way of dealing with economic crises. Let's start with what the world looked like 30 years ago before Woz and Jobs showed up with the Apple I.
Well, of course, the world of computing was dominated by the mainframes and IBM. A computer still had this tinge of giant brain, this electronic thing that would think faster than all of us put together. And they were owned by large organizations and corporations. You never really saw them. You could look at them through maybe some glass windows, and there were a bunch of sort of file cabinet or refrigerator-like boxes. Mm-hmm. And then the information went in and the information came out. And people would sometimes, to impress other people, would walk around waving huge stacks of fanfold 14-inch wide paper computer printouts.
Yes, the printouts. And the IBM card. Don't forget the IBM card.
Well, the IBM card with the Hollerith card, that was also, I guess you could walk around with boxes of those cards, but it was sort of more a nerdy thing to do.
But my student ID when I was at UC Berkeley was actually an IBM card.
So was mine.
Yes, and that's why they came up with the slogan, "Do not fold, bend, spindle, or mutilate me," because that was printed right on your card.
On pretty much every such card.
Right.
Anyway.
But okay, so 1976, there was a group of people meeting, in Silicon Valley and around the Bay Area?
At the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, pretty much.
And this was the Homebrew Club?
Homebrew Computer Club, yeah.
And when Wozniak showed up with the Apple, was it the Apple I, right?
Well, Wozniak was there at the first meeting in Gordon French's garage.
Mm-hmm.
And we have on record, everybody there made a little statement, most of the people, that about what their name and address was and interest. And that was printed in the first newsletter. Fred Moore did that. He convened the meeting. And Woz's statement was that he was working on, he had done Breakout, a game, electronic game, that I guess there was no computer games mm-hmm. at that point. Not true. We'll get to that later. But and then he was interested in working on some sort of TV typewriter and that sort of thing.
Right, and there had been an article about TV typewriter prior to that.
The TV typewriter was September 1973 Radio Electronics. It was a magazine aimed at repair service technicians.
Mm-hmm.
And this was Build Your Own TV Typewriter. And what they showed on the cover was a TV screen with those words on it. Does it, you know, put up letters and words on your own TV screen, and a little keyboard with a couple of hands coming in from off the screen, and the message was very clear. You could get sufficient control over your TV to put your own message on there mm-hmm. with this if you had this box. And to have the box, you had to build it. And to do that, you had to have the plans, which were far too extensive to print in the magazine. So they said, what they usually did for when they had a complex project, send in a self-addressed stamped envelope and $2.
Why didn't they just put it on their website?
Website? What's that? Web? What's that?
And where did the Altair, that preceded this also, is that right?
No. And 75 was the Altair. January 75, Popular Electronics.
Right, so it did precede it by a little, preceded the Apple II, I mean.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
And as I remember, the Altair didn't have a keyboard. In fact, I don't even think it had a screen. It had switches and lights.
It had switches and lights. And when you opened the box, it was mostly empty. Mm-hmm. There was a processor card in there with an 8080 on it, as an Intel's chip. And then there was a memory card, which had four sockets for static memory. Each of them would be 256 bytes of memory. And only one socket had a chip in it.
Wow. So what did Apple bring to the table? What was different about what Woz and, I guess, Jobs were showing versus all the other things you were looking at the time?
Well, some may say, which would be incorrect, that they They put it all in one box with a keyboard. But in fact, a computer that I designed had done that, the Sol, using the 8080.
Yeah.
And we got that one shown, and the order book opened in at the PC76 first computer show in Atlantic City in Labor Day 1976.
So you actually preceded the Apple.
That's correct. And they've got a Sol in the Smithsonian exhibit on the showing the Homebrew Club and stuff. Of course, they put it on the floor. I guess that's politics.
Now, with all due respect, you've been a very successful guy, and you later went on to create the Osborne One and many other things. But clearly, the Sol didn't have quite the impact. We're not celebrating the Sol's 31st right. anniversary right now.
Yes.
So they must have done something right that maybe you just didn't quite do.
Right. Success counts a great deal. Actually, somebody else had built a computer, the Sphere, mm-hmm. in a 75, which had a keyboard and a screen, and they sold almost none of them.
Yeah.
So I'm already relying on, you know, how much did you sell? The Sol sold about 12,000.
That's not bad.
That's not bad, but it's not the Apple II.
But the Apple I itself, that sold, did anybody actually buy an Apple I, or was that just kind of a demo unit?
No, they sold about 200 of them.
They did?
Yeah, and in fact, one of them sold recently for $14,000.
Wow, expensive PC. And the Apple II, of course, became their mass market product. That's the one that I bought that got me into the world of computing.
And many, many others. The important thing was that the Apple II was taking a kind of different view. It was a more playful computer than all of the others put together.
Mm-hmm.
It had color output, which is a very ingenious piece of engineering by Steve Wozniak. And it had a easy plug-in situation where you didn't have to set up addresses on the card with little dip switches and stuff. You didn't have to be an engineer to use it. You plugged the card in, it found the card, and it went from there.
Mm-hmm.
So it had much more sophisticated software, I would say.
How important was the built-in keyboard and the adapter for the screen? I mean, I know you had done that, but basically, had anybody else tried to market a product that had a similar design in that sense?
Well, aside from the Sol, I will venture to say no. Some historian will probably fish up something else.
But was that an important element of it as well, the fact that you could actually interact with it without having to flip switches?
Well, I think it's all important because, to me, a personal computer has an integral screen, mm-hmm. display screen, and that screen is integrated very tightly into the design of the computer. And when you look at a display screen, you're looking at a piece of memory, data in memory. And that memory has to be the same as the main memory of the computer.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be sitting off to one side in a terminal.
Right, which was the old model, model that existed even into the 80s, which is the terminal connected to the mainframe or the mini or whatever.
And even the Altair was like that.
Mm-hmm.
The computer had to decide what was supposed to be on the screen, interpret that into some sort of language, transmit that through a line to another device called the terminal, and that would, in fact, represent it according to what it thought it had been told.
Well, wait a minute, Lee. Jumping 30 years ahead, isn't that what Google is? Isn't that what the web is? Basically, your PC is just a terminal onto the Internet.
Yes, and that's one of my major critiques. When online use of computers became important, it reverted back to the teletype days where you had a terminal here and a computer there. So much of what could have been done in the personal computer itself was actually done at the server, which is the new name for the mainframe.
Right, exactly. So in a sense, and I want to get back to the 70s, but in a sense we have come full circle where, just like I did when I was writing my doctoral dissertation in the late 70s, I'm sitting at a device, but the real work is happening somewhere else. In
yes.
this case, a server. In that case, we called it a mainframe.
Yeah, well, we had a little experiment that you might have heard of called the Community Memory Project.
Sure.
And in that, we were trying to use 2,400 baud lines, because that's all we could get from the modems we had at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we developed quite an intelligent device that ran in the bottom level IBM PC, skipping forward a few years here. At any rate, you can do a great deal in a small computer. The easiest thing to do is just have that computer say, whatever that computer said, that's what I'm showing. But that's not making good use of the technology.
Going back to 76, give me a sense of what motivated you guys. If you can think about Wozniak and the people that were gathered together, what were you really trying to accomplish?
Well, I've been greatly aided in thinking about this recently by John Markoff's recent book, What the Dormouse Said. And I've come to the conclusion that the marketing for the personal computer for years had been done by the Whole Earth Catalog and Stuart Brand. If you look at in the Wikipedia at their statement of purpose, I guess, you will see right there the idea that we are society is in a kind of a crisis, and we to solve this, we need to be able to have tools in the hands of a very wide range of people, not just in the hands of experts. And so that catalog was all about people learning to use tools, sometimes traditional tools that had fallen into disuse and sometimes new tools. Now, Stuart Brand got into this whole thing because he discovered a tool that he considered augmented the mind, which is psychedelic drugs. Well, he grew from there. And I think that when we finally got our hands on computers, everybody was really, to one extent or another, trying to implement the vision of the Whole Earth Catalog.
Yeah.
And I think it's been very clearly stated.
Aren't we doing that right now in the sense that we're doing a podcast, which is, in a sense, and I happen to work for a broadcasting network, but you don't have to have the credentials of a CBS News to do what we're doing. Anybody with a PC and a microphone can do this today.
Absolutely. That's a very great example. And between that and the distribution channel of the web, which I consider one of their, maybe this generation's greatest achievement technologically.
And the blogging, of course, there are individuals out there that are getting as many hits on their websites as CNN is getting viewers on its television network.
Things are changing.
Yeah. But again, going back, so you guys, I don't know if you foresaw this, but when you were working collectively, competitively to try to create these early personal computers, you were actually thinking about the fact that a computer could actually belong to an individual and not to an insurance company or a government agency or a university, or not just to those kinds of organizations.
Well, that idea was what brought us together in the first place. And it had been explicated in little publications like Creative Computing and People's Computer Company. Mm-hmm. Nothing seriously mainstream, but then we started out as 30 people.
Right. Where was Steve Jobs in all this?
Steve Jobs wasn't at the first meeting. I don't remember when he first showed up. It had to be in the first few meetings.
Mm-hmm.
He struck me as being someone who never spoke.
Hmm.
Steve Wozniak never spoke at the mapping session, where at one person at a time got up, and with my legendary pointer, I would point to them. And people would make a short announcement of what they wanted to talk to other people about. Steve wasn't that out front, but he was always there. And he would, when we were in this black auditorium, Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, there was one position where there was an outlet. And he always took that position, that seat. And so and when we broke up into the random access session, he would have his stuff. He'd be showing his stuff to anybody who was interested.
This is Wozniak.
This is Wozniak. Yeah. And Jobs would be moving around. He was everywhere, listening, learning. I never heard him say anything.
Hmm.
And that's very interesting. And so those were the times when he was learning what he had to learn.
I mean, the story has it, of course, is that Wozniak was a technological genius and Jobs was a marketing genius.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
It's just that I never saw Jobs in action there. Although maybe I did see him in action, I never heard him in action.
Now, Apple, fast-forwarding 30 years, is known for elegance and style, ease of use. It is definitely sort of the more refined device, certainly compared to the myriad of Windows PCs. And if you look at the iPod, how incredibly successful they've been with that. And again, it has a lot to do with style. Was that at all an issue back then, with very people even thinking along those lines?
It wasn't a very big issue, I'll put it that way. We were much more interested in, does it work? How much can you do with it? What are the limitations? How are we going to get past those limitations?
Now, so the Apple One came out in 76. When did the Apple II come out, do you recall?
77, at the first computer fair.
At the fair. That was the West Coast Computer Fair in San Francisco, which went on for many years. Jim Warren, I guess, was running it back then as well?
Jim Warren, yes. He went on to found InfoWorld.
Yeah. And when I got involved, which was admittedly several years later, I got to choose between an Apple II, a Radio Shack, was it Model 1?
Model 1, right.
And I believe there was a PET Commodore out there, if I'm not mistaken.
Commodore PET, right.
Commodore PET. interesting, Apple is the only company of those that's still in the PC business. Radio Shack still, of course, is in, well, they sell PCs, but they don't make them.
Right.
Any idea why Apple won? At least won that round?
I think that they staked out a certain market area, which is not the majority market. Style is important there. And this is not to put it down. I like the style of Apple. I don't use it, but that's for practical reasons. And they have provided a product that is superior in many regards. It's more stable than the other product.
Now, of course, Windows. We're talking about Windows versus Mac as opposed to Apple II versus what was out there at the time.
Well, yes.
But Apple II was very stable. It hardly ever crashed.
To the extent that I'd ever, you know, I did use it, let's say, when we were planning Osborne Computer.
Well, you used CPM, and CPM didn't crash either.
Right.
And nor did even the early versions of DOS. All of those computers were a lot more reliable than they are today, interestingly enough.
Yes. Well, I have many opinions on that. Whether you want to get into them here or not is another matter.
Well, it is a very, time. I mean, even, you know, comparing the Apple II and the Mac or comparing MS-DOS and Windows, I mean, I know from my own experience, people love to talk about the Mac, but they do deteriorate over time. They slow down. They occasionally even crash.
Yes. That shouldn't happen. And there's a lot that happens that shouldn't. In effect, we have gone backwards from established standards of reliability mostly with the Windows. And it's people will put up with it. Put up with it.
Yeah.
But then I'm an engineer, and engineers use flawed, imperfect tools.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that there's a reason why everybody should have flawed, imperfect
tools.
Right.
Maybe you know how to recover from these disasters. The average person just sort of pulls their hair out.
Yeah.
Now, you came up with the Osborne 1. I know it was the early 80s. Help me tell me the date about that.
Well, it was 1980, June 1980 when we started.
Before IBM announced its PC.
That's correct.
Right. So at that point, we had the Apple II that was dominant. We had the Radio Shack. We had CPM. And the CPM, which was the operating system that you used for the Osborne, was really the predominant operating system for the business market. Apple was kind of in business a little bit, but more still kind of consumer hobbyist, if
yes,
I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it was carving out a non-business niche, which wasn't that hard to carve out because that's kind of where we started, but it built that niche.
Mm-hmm.
CPM was important because it would work across platforms and set the standard for that. And I think there's just been a book out about sort of technological history of America written by a British guy, I think named Hughes, I'm not sure. Evans. Mm-hmm. And it makes the point that Gary Kildall, who developed the concept and developed CPM, really was the founder of personal computing.
Yes.
In the world.
And had things gone a little differently, aside from the sad tragedy that Gary died, he could have been the next Bill Gates had he signed a different contract with IBM.
That's been posited, and I'm not sure that it's that simple.
Yeah.
He was not the same kind of person that Bill Gates is. He's a very easygoing, generous guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't mind if people ripped off the program because there was plenty to go around.
But as I remember, because I actually was part of that development team as a author of the Easy Writer Manual and for IBM, and I remember that CPM came out a little later than MS-DOS, but they both came out under the IBM logo. And they were both sold. Neither one of them came with a computer. So
yeah.
Had CPM come out earlier and had history gone a little differently, maybe more people would have chosen CPM instead of MS-DOS.
Well, if they had included CPM with the bare metal, as we did with the Osborne, it would all have been over.
But remember, the early IBM didn't. Now, the Apple II did. The Apple II did come with an operating system. You had to load it off of a floppy disk. The early IBM, that was a buying decision you made. But at the time that they shipped in August 81, you only had one choice, which was MS-DOS, or what they called PC-DOS.
And it was based heavily on CPM. There's this story, which I give credence to, that the first 1.1 version of MS-DOS, you could find the CPM copyright notice in there.
I haven't seen that. Now, what is interesting about the time, if you look again, this is where I sort of stepped on not the stage, but behind the scenes writing the manual for Easy Writer, that had been one of the best-selling programs for the Apple II. The best-selling program for the IBM PC at the time in 81, 82 was VisiCalc, which again was an Apple II product. So
right.
If you look back at Apple, aside from the fact that their legacy continues because the company's still around, they really set the stage that IBM then took over.
Yes.
And dominated.
Absolutely. And I think Estrin, whoever led the development team, said, you know, if those guys started in a garage, we have to start in a garage. He was referring to Apple without doubt.
Yeah, that's right. And he tried to run his operation in Boca Raton relatively closely, although I'll tell you it was still very bureaucratic, of course. But I'm wondering again, so IBM comes on the scene and Jobs puts out an ad, you know, welcome IBM seriously. You remember that ad, basically, again, 81. IBM very quickly eclipsed Apple with the Apple II versus the IBM PC. I suspect it was better technology, but it wasn't that much better.
Now, the IBM technology, I'll tell you this right now, from the display standpoint, was inferior to anything that was available at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody but IBM could have gotten away with their crummy video.
That green screen.
No, well,
and
that
the
was
optional
the monochrome. The color.
Two choices, yeah. Oh, the color was terrible.
The color was terrible.
I didn't even buy one of those. I got the green one.
And you got screen interruptions on the left-hand side, which long ago, I mean, I designed the VDM1 in 75 that interrupted the screen because that's the fastest memories we could get. But you couldn't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
IBM came along, hey, we can do it. We're an 800-pound gorilla.
But nevertheless, Apple kind of went into a little bit of obscurity for a while.
Well, of course, the market was growing, and IBM was able to seize a bigger part of the market that had not committed to anything yet. No one outfit could supply the whole market, although I'm sure everybody felt they could.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yes, Apple didn't take everything over. No one was going to take everything over. And there were a lot of people who still lived by the old adage, nobody ever got fired for buying IBM.
But then January 1984, Steve Jobs and Wozniak were there, although Wozniak was not a major player in the Mac. He was kind of on the sidelines. They introduced Macintosh, which just about every pundit I knew, myself included, considered to be an order of magnitude better than what IBM was offering and what Compaq and other companies were offering at the time. Yet it, too, never reached double-digit market share.
I'm not about to criticize that because I don't know what the considerations were. Sometimes you have to keep your horizon small in order to survive. I don't know if that's what was going on with Macintosh. It might have been. The Mac, definitely, everybody who had seen the Xerox Alto knew the Mac was lineal descendant of that. And that was a whole different paradigm.
This is the story that Steve Jobs and I believe and Bill Gates and probably yourself and others had seen Xerox's prototypes that looked a lot like what the Mac and Windows look like, right?
Yeah, a lot of people had taken the backdoor tour at Xerox Park. I did it in 1973. And we came away saying, man, I want that. How can I have that? But of course you can't because it cost $10,000 or more to put it together at that time. So when we began building our stuff, everybody had that in mind. And the Mac was really the first breakthrough. I mean, there was the Lisa before that, but that was just a prototype in effect. And it really wasn't a very successful. It wasn't successful at all, actually.
Right.
So it was their attempt to sort of try out one way of doing it, discover that that's the wrong way to do it, and then keep doing it a different way.
Now, fast forwarding very quickly to the, I guess, early 2000s or maybe late 90s, I can't remember exactly when it was, Apple introduces the iPod. Talk about double digit. They own the market. They literally own the, 70% of the digital music players come from this one company.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's not a personal computer. I know that this is not your area of expertise, but it's a computer company that comes out with a consumer electronics product that dominates and continues to dominate despite some incredibly good competitive products.
Well, they did pretty much everything right as far as I can tell. I have an iPod, which I hardly ever use, but it was a gift from my wife.
You're not their demographic target there.
Well, I'm not the people who walk around with their earbuds blaring. And
the good news is you'll keep your hearing a little longer.
Well, such as I have.
Yeah, you still have it, yeah. No, but seriously, go on about this.
Well, the iPod, actually, I'm quite interested in the iPod because I make my living designing consumer products. Everybody in that field compares their market to the iPod. Well, iPod did this much, so we can certainly do it with this completely different product.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some reason for this because the iPod is a little bit of storage, it's a lot of storage, and it's got a human interface, a user interface, and it's got an audio channel, and now it's got a video channel.
Right.
And you could hook up a lot of things to that.
Are you suggesting it's a computer?
Well, it's always got a computer in it. Whether I would call it a personal computer using my cosmology for that, I don't know.
So this is a product which worked.
Yes.
And I guess thinking back to your many products that you've designed, the Osborne One was a good example. It not only did it work, but you had everything you needed to be productive. It came, in fact, as I recall, what was it? It was $1,700 and came with $2,500 worth of software or something like that.
Yeah, which is a good example of the strange pricing of software. But yes, in fact, that was Adam Osborne's real marketing innovation was, you have a box, it's got a handle on it, it's closed up, you open it up, and it's the whole computer, and it's got everything you need, including software. The iPod is like that. It's a classic design in that it just sort of falls into your hand, you can use it easily, and there's no real gee whiz factor to it. This is something designers often try for, but they shouldn't.
Maybe you have to be a geek or French to care about it. But this whole notion of a closed system, and I'm referring to the French because their National Assembly just passed a bill which would essentially allow people to, in a way, hack into Apple's iTunes digital rights management over the whole issue of the Macintosh, I'm sorry, of the iPod being a closed system. You got to buy your music from Apple. You got to buy your hardware from Apple. There isn't that level of interdependability as you have in the Windows world. Obviously, that isn't a problem for their market at this moment.
It's not a problem for that market. It's record market, in effect. And it doesn't seem to be any problem for me. You know, I'll buy my music where I can buy it. If that's where I buy it, I'd like to have a broader selection of music. But I'm not dependent upon the music.
So you're not ideologically bothered by the fact that Apple is locking you in. It would be as if you bought a CD from Sony Music, you had to play it on a Sony CD player.
Well, I would resent that if the quality of the Sony products was low.
Mm-hmm. Which it probably would be, yeah.
Well, I don't know. Sony makes good stuff in general, but you know, they don't seem to have much of a marketing clue in general, whereas Apple really does.
I find this fascinating because I mean, I know a lot about your beliefs and your politics. I don't know, politics is the right word. And you're not the kind of guy who I would normally associate supporting the idea of a closed system. Yet a lot of people are somehow accepting of what Apple is doing. If Microsoft did that, wouldn't they get kicked in the butt by a lot of people?
Well, they might. And let me qualify this here. I believe that it is inevitable that the iPod will be hacked and that it should be because nobody should count on having total ownership over a technology. Technology belongs to everybody. And it's just a matter of will they take the time and effort to learn it. And all the rules about, oh, you can't do that, you know, with the copyright and so forth. We didn't pay any attention to those in the early homebrew days. We were passing around copies of Altair Basic that Microsoft thought they were going to get $500 for. Well,
I remember a memo from Bill Gates about that.
We sent an open letter to the community calling us all thieves, telling us to send in your money now. And everybody laughed at it. And what happened when National Semiconductor, maybe it was Fairchild, I don't know which, said, okay, we need a BASIC for our chip. Okay, what's the most popular BASIC? Everybody said, Microsoft. And their market was made. We did the marketing for Bill Gates.
So Bill Gates wouldn't be the richest man in the world if it were for pirates like you.
In effect, yes. And piracy and business go hand in hand.
Well, even when you shipped the Osborne One with a copy of WordStar, which is the word processing program at the time, it was heavily pirated. I mean, there were thousands, tens of thousands of copies floating around of that program that weren't paid for.
Which makes the market bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And in a growth situation, that's what you want. That's more valuable than making the market small and extracting as much money as you can from each one.
Well, we want to wrap up, or I want to wrap up, but I guess I want to move back and you know, get you to put on your looking back and looking forward hat. What have we learned in 30 years, and where do we take this?
I could spend a long time talking about what we've learned in 30 years. However, from this one aspect of Apple, when you're dealing with computers in ordinary people's hands, style matters. ease of use is very, very important. Gee whiz and technical glitz is much less important. And they really did a good job of understanding that balance. The whole sort of yes, but mine is faster doesn't really mean anything. You want it to come closer to the merger of TV and computer, which is really what the personal computer is. And I think that Apple certainly has understood that over the years as they've gone, starting with the color screen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe I should have asked you this at the beginning, but I'll ask it now. What are you doing?
Well, I am trying to establish an industry that will bring village owned and operated telecommunications extensions to the developing world.
Very interesting.
It's a huge market, and it's really necessary. I was prodded into this by 9/11. Mm-hmm. I remembered my upbringing. I was born in 1945, so I missed World War II, but we saw it all on the TV screen, and the smoke billowing from Pearl Harbor reminded me of the smoke from the Twin Towers.
Absolutely.
And how America contributed to that war was with its productive capacity. My father went to work as a machinist, and millions of others didn't. We outproduced everybody, and we need to do that again. And here is the need. There are people who have to leave their farms, that don't want to leave them, go to the cities where it's total squalor and crime and so forth, create huge problems for everybody. All they need really is to be able to get into the marketplace in their farms. And telecommunications does that. This has been proven. And it's possible with wireless, Wi-Fi, VoIP, open source hardware and software to get that capacity to them. And the people who will get it to them are their people who have gone to industrialized countries, their diasporas. So I've written a paper on this, and I'm continuing to work on the missing pieces technologically, and that's really what inflames me.
What do you think of Nicholas Negroponte's $100 laptop?
I'm one of the biggest critics of that.
Really?
Because they are not paying any attention to the infrastructure. They've begun to acknowledge that there's some need there.
And it's totally dependent on the infrastructure, isn't it?
But the infrastructure isn't there. That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, I see. So they're building the appliances before the electrical outlets are in.
That's right. And in fact, the whole business about you've got a crank on it for power, they know that won't work. They've acknowledged that in quiet. But they say we have to retain some sort of statement that it's optional because mm-hmm. otherwise nobody will believe us.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Won't work because you couldn't generate enough power, or because the infrastructure isn't bringing the data where it needs to get.
It's because you can't get enough power. I did the calculations on the crank according to their claims, and it was impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And those are high school level calculations. Why didn't MIT do that? Well, we'll see.
Maybe from a marketing standpoint, the crank makes it look awfully good.
Oh, it's a nice marketing thing, but it's completely meaningless technologically.
But in order to make this or any other device work in the developing world, are you suggesting we need to have an internet infrastructure? We have to have
Absolutely.
An electrical infrastructure? I mean, we've got a long way to go.
That's correct, and it's not a simple problem. So I'm talking about what will it take to put one computer in each village, which can be used as a phone and immediately raise the incomes of the local farmers, as versus one laptop per child, which will, after the child goes through their education, somehow, in an unstated fashion, improve everything for everybody. People want their technology to show results now.
How I can understand how you might get the one computer in the village. How are you going to get the internet to the village?
Oh, but that comes with that computer. It's meaningless unless you have the internet there. So in effect, that really is the problem. Again, wireless, Wi-Fi, and WiMAX are major contenders for the local distribution system. Satellite, VSAT, is probably the major backbone channel, the backhaul, as we call it. But there's a lot of work to be done in that area.
And then the question is, if it's a choice between a roof over the community center and a computer, don't they have to put the roof up first?
Well, they don't want to have the computer getting wet. Sure. And in Laos, in the villages we were trying to pioneer this in, the villagers had gone ahead and built an extension room on their school just for the computer.
I remember when I was in the middle of the Amazon River on an island, and I was talking on a satellite phone, and the people were looking at me strange, and I think, oh, of course, they've never seen a satellite phone. I said, wait a minute. They've never seen a telephone.
That's right. Well, who is this idiot who's talking to a lump of something?
That's right. Well, Lee, I really appreciate you taking the time, and I guess we can all wish Apple a happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Apple.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Larry's World with Larry Magid. please visit Larry's site at www.larrysworld.com. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Paul Figiani. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of Larry's World on IT Conversations.